Blog Talk Radio.
On Monday, February the 11th, day number 42 of 2013, and today we're going to catch up with our good friend Jim Yardley. Jim, of course, is a friend in New York as well as a contributor to the American Thinker. He recently posted a very interesting article about the Bill of Rights, so we're going to get into that with Jim as well. First of all, let me thank the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program today. It's on the front page, and we appreciate that very much. What it usually means is that we'll be introduced to a lot of new listeners today, and if you're listening to us for the first time, thank you, and come back. We like to do these shows as much as possible and bring you good content like we do today, or we will do today, with Jim Yardley of the American Thinker. Obviously, the big story today, I mean, front page story, headline story, it hasn't happened in 600 years, so I guess that's a big story. Pope Benedict announcing that he'll be resigning at the end of the month, and we'll get into a little bit of that with Jim in our segment in a couple of minutes. Our sponsor today, my book, Cubanos in Wisconsin. This is a book that I just published. It's about our family coming to the United States. It's available on Amazon. I have a link to it on the show information. It's a story about family. It's a story about freedom. It's a story of our family coming here and ending up in Wisconsin, which is, of course, not where you would usually think Cuban families would end up, but we were relocated up there by a church, and that's where I begin my American story as a kid up in Wisconsin. I'm very proud of the book. I love the reviews we've been getting. Great reviews. In fact, there was a great review by Richard Baer at the American Thinker that we had recently. So I want to thank everybody who's bought the book. I want to thank everybody who's given me a review, and I know there's a few more coming. We have a couple of options. You can go to the website and get the book directly from Amazon, or there's also the option of getting the book autographed. And if you want to buy a book for your Cuban grandfather, it would be a great honor for me to autograph the book that way for your Cuban father or mother or Cuban grandparents or whatever. I think it would make a great gift. I think they would enjoy the book very well. CubanosInWisconsin.com. You can find the book right there. And if you got some comments, hey, let me know. We'd like to hear from our readers as much as possible. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Jim Yardley right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and speaking of the Catholic Church, we just mentioned the headline about the Pope resigning on this day in history, 1858. A young woman, Bernadette, in the southern France, in the southern part of France, had her first meeting with the Virgin Mary, and that was, of course, one of the great stories of the Catholic Church. She, of course, was made a saint in 1933, Saint Bernadette, and millions of people go to that place today to pray. Of course, later there was another one in Lourdes, Portugal, but this one, Bernadette, occurring in South France. And on this day in 1861, a man by the name of Abraham Lincoln left Springfield, Illinois, and took the train to Washington, D.C. to become president of the United States. So on this day, a couple of big things that happened in history. Let's say hello to Jim Yardley. How are you, Jim?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Great. I got to ask you, because you're up in New York, you got to give us a weather report about the snow.
Well, I live about 60 miles north of Manhattan, and we got about 16 or 18 inches. But anything over an inch, it's like, okay, stop counting. You're just making yourself sick.
Right.
But we were able to get all the snow blown out of the driveway, and we're surviving.
You're back to normal, I guess, right?
As normal as I ever get, yeah.
That's right, that's right. Well, Jim, I know you've been on the show before, but I always like our guests to tell us a little bit about themselves. So take a minute and give us a quick biography of Jim Yardley.
Well, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, studied English as a foreign language, and they let me leave. And I think I've lived in 7 different states. So I always think of myself as an American, not a New Yorker. My background is in finance. I've worked for several large manufacturing companies. The last one was Remington Firearms, which gives me a certain sensitivity to the whole gun control issue.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, look, guys, my pension depends on this.
That's right. That's a good point.
But I'm married. I've got 2 kids, 2 grandkids, both nauseatingly bright. Every time I get one of the stories from my kids of what the grandkids are up to, I kind of shake my head and go, oh, they took after their mother, you know.
And she's probably
can't be me.
She's probably listening, so be careful.
I have lived my whole life in trouble, so I don't get fazed by that. And I retired a couple of years ago, and that's when I started writing for American Thinker on a more or less full-time basis.
Yes, and you have quite an archive of articles. We have a link to your archives on the show information, quite a few interesting articles, like the very latest one that you wrote about the Bill of Rights. We're going to get to that in a minute. But the big story, the big story today about Pope Benedict resigning at the end of the month, you know, it has not happened in 600 years, so that's kind of different in a way. But, you know, if he is not up to the job, I appreciate him having the Pope having the seriousness of saying, you know what, I just can't do it anymore. Let somebody else do it, and I'll just retire. I appreciate that, because the last thing you want is a pope. Look, I love John Paul II, but the last few years of his life, he was really very sick and was not able to do what he did for the first 20 when he was one of the greatest popes ever. So if he is not up to it, hey, retire and let a younger man come in. So that's kind of how I feel about it.
Well, as we spoke before the show started, in the past, really until this century or the 20th century, it would be almost impossible to expect anyone in the papacy to live to be 85. They would have all died much younger. So it, you know, not being up to it was not really a question. With the advances in medical science that we've had today, people are living so much longer, but they're not young men anymore. They don't have the strength, they don't have the vigor to carry out what is a fairly difficult task.
Right, and one of the things that John Paul II did, he sort of redefined the job. You know, there's a lot more travel now, and the Pope has to really just about visit every continent, you know. And these trips, my goodness, these trips can be very taxing on a 40-year-old man. Imagine an 85 or whatever I think the Pope is. So I'm, you know, we're grateful that he was a Pope. He was a pretty good Pope. And I'm hoping that we have a young man who becomes Pope, maybe hopefully a man in his early 50s, who can look forward to good health and a good 20-year run as Pope or something like that. And, you know, we can have a younger person. But it's a very difficult job. I don't think people realize the amount of administrative responsibility that he has, but the travel is what really, I think, gets to any Pope. But anyway, we wish him well. Well, let's talk a little, before we get to your article that you wrote about the Bill of Rights, let's just cover a couple of current events here, and I thought you might have an opinion on these. Were you as, I guess, if the right word is shocked, I don't know, maybe that's not the right word, surprised, whatever the right word, about learning that President Obama on the night of Benghazi was disconnected from what was going on? Were you surprised?
Not at all. not at all. Our president is the most risk-averse person I've ever known or known of. He's not going to stick his neck out under any circumstances when he has an opportunity to rig the game so someone else will get blamed if it goes south, but he can take credit if it's successful. I can't imagine anyone who chose to run for office, got himself elected to office in the state Senate of Illinois, and then voted present. I'm not going to offend anybody. I'll just say I'm here. That's risk aversion. And he has pretty much operated during the first term of his presidency on that basis. If people didn't like Obamacare, well, Congress wrote it. But if they do like it, it's Obamacare.
Right. Yeah, if 7 million people lose their health insurance, hey, it's that Congress who passed it. Don't look at me, right?
It's the obstructionist Republicans.
That's right. That's right, yeah. But eventually, though, I mean, I know what you're saying, but I'm not so sure he can get away with that forever, because there's some problems in North Africa, Middle East, Egypt, Libya. There are some really serious stuff on the plate, and I'm not sure he's going to be able to avoid it completely. I don't know. I don't think so.
He's been successful at it so far.
Well, he has.
He really has.
Yeah, he has. You're right about that.
And he has spent a lifetime perfecting that. You know, as I wrote once, he is the Bart Simpson president. I didn't do it. Nobody saw me. You can't prove anything.
Right. Yes. Except that we need a serious man with some of the problems that we have. And I wish we had a different personality, because we got some serious problems. Some of them are going to come up in the State of the Union tomorrow night. I've heard all kinds of things that he's going to try to focus on jobs and the economy, which is makes me wonder, why is he doing that in the fifth year of his presidency when that should have been done in year one? You know, that's just amazing.
Well, I don't know whether he's going to focus on it. He'll bring it up and say, well, it's my most important priority. I can almost guarantee that phrase will be there. But there will not be any supporting plan, because, to go back to the comment of being risk-averse, here is a man who would never start his own business, ever, because an entrepreneur lays it all on the line, their life, their treasure, everything, to make that business work. He's not willing to risk anything. So he has nothing in common with entrepreneurs who do risk everything. And if they're successful, he claims it's his credit. You didn't build that. Barry, actually, I did build that. I don't remember you being here sweeping up after we locked the doors.
No. Well, but I think part of the reason he gets away with it, or he gets away with this kind of approach, Jim, is because it seems to me he's got this political safety net of supporters who are very strong supporters of his, who just basically give him cover. And that's what scares me about this man, that he can be unserious, incompetent, risk-averse, and he's probably always going to maintain a certain degree of support. I mean, I cannot see Barack Obama dropping the 30% approval or 35% approval. He's always going to be between 40 and 45, or maybe even 45 and 50, because, again, he has a very loyal base. And I don't know why, but they're very loyal to him.
Well, because Republicans, by and large, are in desperate need of a good PR firm.
Well, that's true, too.
Desperately. And a good advertising agency. I'm very serious.
I know.
They try very hard to explain their position, explain logically why their suggestions make sense. Obama and the Democrats don't. They simply say, Oh, those suggestions? Those Republican suggestions? They're evil. They're trying to throw grandma off a cliff. They're trying to starve children with absolutely no support for these claims. But the term that came up in the last election, low information voters.
Right.
People that get their news from John Stewart.
Right.
They have no way to tell whether or not that's true.
Right, and also
none whatsoever.
The MTV crowd. I mean, he goes on MTV. I mean, I think it basically told everything about Barack Obama when, you know, right after the Benghazi incident, he's going on The View, he's going on MTV. I mean, he's going on Jon Stewart. I mean, he's going to those venues where there's nothing serious. And I think, you know, at the time, maybe we didn't understand why he was doing that. But I think we know now. He was taking care of the low-information voters, make sure they went out to vote. And I think they represented something like 3 or 4 million voters who were just about what he needed to get reelected. But another reason, I think, and which is a little bit of what you're touching in your article about the Bill of Rights versus Bill of Goods, is that there's a certain dependency that has been created, you know, in the country. So a lot of people are voting their benefits. They don't necessarily care whether you're good or bad. They just want to make sure you deliver the benefits. And I think that's a bit of a crisis for a democracy when you get to that point, which kind of leads.
I think it's even. I really think it's even worse than that.
Yeah.
It's not. Oh, what are you going to give me free now? I'll vote for you, but don't take my stuff away.
Right.
That's a real fear. Art Laffer had an article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was today, talking about welfare and all the medical services and all that that the government provides, free. Now, you take a single mother. She's fine if she's earning up to, say, $10,000 a year, which is just barely minimum wage. Once she crosses that threshold, her marginal tax rate jumps to 100% because for every dollar she earns, they take away a dollar of benefits.
Interesting.
So there's absolutely no incentive for this individual to give up those benefits in order to advance professionally in a career.
Right.
That's where the hook comes. It's not so much the, oh, we're going to help you with your health care. It's, and if you try to be successful, we're going to take it away from you.
Right.
So you have to stay on the plantation.
That's an excellent point. Now, was that an article? I didn't see that one. Was that in the print or the online version?
I think it was in the print version.
In the print version, yeah, because I got to read that. That's an amazing. I like Mr. Laffer. He writes really good stuff. Well, let's talk about your article in the American Thinker, the latest one you wrote, caught my attention about the Bill of Rights. You're kind of touching a little bit on what we were just talking about, aren't you?
Well, yeah. The Bill of Goods was from an article that Cass Sunstein had written in Bloomberg.com. And he was basically parroting the same second Bill of Rights that FDR proposed. And as I pointed out in the article, it's just the kind of thing Obama loves. It has soaring rhetoric. It all sounds good. But then when you look at the actual words, for example, every American should have the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. And my question is, okay, how much money is enough? Who decides what amount of food is adequate? Who decides if, well, adequate clothing is Versace, or are we going to Mayo jackets? And finally, exactly when did we start being responsible as a society for how people amuse themselves and how they participate in recreation? Another one was, every person has a right to a decent home. Well, decent is kind of a slippery word. Does that mean the federal government will be mandating building codes, zoning rules? Will a person who has more than just a predefined decent house get taxed because they have too much house? Every one of these words that's built into this particular document, the decent home, adequate medical care, adequate protection, good education, they're all qualitative terms. And we've seen with Obama, he loves those, like fair. That's not a quantitative term. That's a qualitative term. And he has in his mind a definition of what's fair, but he's not sharing it with the rest of us. So that means it can change from day to day.
Right. And I would think the other thing, too, is that these are, you know, these are the kinds of things, like you were saying, that sound good. You know, you hear, well, everybody's entitled to a living wage. That's the other word that they like to use a great deal. And that sounds kind of decent, you know. But then you say, what does that mean? Give me a number. What is a living wage? I mean, a living wage, for example, if I were to ask you, Jim, what is a living wage to you? Well, does that mean you get to live a middle-class life? Does that mean you get to live in upper middle class? You see what I mean?
Exactly.
It makes it very difficult to define, but it sounds good. It's the kind of stuff that you go on a program like The View and you say to an audience, well, you know, everybody should have a living wage, and everybody goes, yeah, that's exactly right. Everybody should. Nobody knows what it means, but it sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's right up there with one of my favorites. From each according to his ability, to each according to their need. Thank you, Karl Marx. Great line. And it's being transferred right over here.
Right. And you would say, thank you, Karl Marx. Thank you for wrecking all these economies who've tried to do this.
Exactly.
That's the other thing, too, that all of the places that have tried to do this, to one degree or another, in a more Stalinist sense, like in the Soviet Union or Cuba, or even in a more democratic sense, like in Europe, where they basically have used this to get elected, the net result is the same. It just doesn't create jobs. It creates economies that are stagnant. And I don't know, what's it going to take to break? Because it's a very addictive habit, or a very addictive addiction, if you forgive me my words.
Well, I think one of the things that I would, if I was the president, and we should all get on our knees and thank God that I'm not, okay? But if I was, the first thing I would do would be put on a complete hiring freeze for all civilian government employees and a complete wage freeze. In 10 years, the government would be reduced by 50%, and you wouldn't have to fire anybody. They'd quit. They'd be tired of working, just the very concept of work. Okay, leave it there. Working. They'd have to work. People would retire as they came due, and you wouldn't be replacing them. So whatever work the government does would be put on the shoulders of a smaller and smaller number who are already told, no, you're not getting a raise. No, you're not getting help. And by the way, if you're a secretary, for example, and you work for the Department of Education, but somebody over at Commerce needs a secretary, you got a new job. You're working over there now. And we may move you again in 3 months. People are going to get tired of that. They're going to go out into the private sector and try to find something. Once you stop spending the money, you can take the taxes without lowering the taxes, without changing the tax rates, and start paying down the debt. By paying down the debt, you're freeing up all those interest payments you're making. And you're filling the economy, the entrepreneurs, the business people, and so on, with a lot more confidence that if they invest money, using the strict definition, not the cockamamie definition that Obama uses, they invest money, they expect to get that money back plus some. They're willing to put their own money into the pot. Right now, they're like, I don't know. If you were playing poker and the dealer was changing the rules midstream, you're not going to bet big.
No. And another thing, too, that's somewhat related to this, sometimes people are betting their own money with a federal loan guarantee, like Solyndra and stuff like that. I mean, none of those projects would have started if people didn't have the federal loan guarantee. So we got to cut that out, too. You know, we got to stop deciding winners and losers and just let the marketplace figure it out. It's done a pretty good job over the centuries figuring that out. So we don't need to adjust that. Let the marketplace figure it out. But my biggest concern, sort of wrap up what you were saying, my biggest concern is the impact that all this debt has on the private sector, which is what you were talking about, because it takes all that cash away from potential jobs and investment, and the culture of dependency that we are creating. That is really, I don't mean to be pessimistic. Hopefully it'll work itself out. But I'm, you know, when you look at Europe, it's difficult not to be pessimistic.
Well, and forgive me for not remembering which polling organization was behind the poll, but 54% of the people they polled thought the economy would never come back.
Wow.
Ever. They just figure we're that far down now. But, you know, in keeping with that second Bill of Rights in the Constitution, it occurred to me that, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, not a lawyer or any of that, but I actually read the documents, which puts me ahead of most of our members of Congress. We have a means to change the Constitution. If these people, these progressives, feel that it's such an antiquated document, fine, change it. You have a method. You have a way of amending the Constitution. And it dawned on me why they won't do it. Because in order to amend the Constitution, you have to go to the people of this country through their state legislatures and ask permission. You can't do it without the states saying, well, all right, we'll let you. Because that document, when you look at the preamble, it says, we the people are creating this government. And the actual language of the Constitution starts with the words Article 1. Anything before that is poetry. It's not law. We should never allow them to get away with using, well, the Constitution provides for the general welfare. No, it doesn't. That's in the preamble. Article 1 says this is what you can do. This is all you can do. This is all we're going to allow you to do because we don't trust you. But if you want to change the Constitution, feel free to ask us for permission. And these people just, the idea of it's like a teenager saying, Mom, can I stay out an extra hour tonight? They don't want to ask permission. They just want to do it without anyone gainsaying them.
Right. And I think the EPA is a good example of that. I mean, here's an organization just totally out of control. I mean, this executive mandate or executive order with the Dreamer kids, you know, the immigration with the Dreamers, a year or so ago. I mean, this is a man who seems to be, who loves to do this because you're right. He doesn't have if he went the right way, if he tried to change things the right way, he couldn't do it. And but I see it. Maybe this could be an idea for a future article for you to consider. But I think eventually the union will break if we keep doing stuff like this because the union was based on the idea that that the states were going to have their say in this. But I don't want to get too pessimistic or get into a difficult topic of secession or whatever. But I cannot see the union staying together if we have presidents who continue to govern at the expense of the Constitution or at the expense of states' rights. Eventually, the union will break up because some states will say, you know, we're out of here. We don't want to participate in this kind of an arrangement anymore. Maybe that's an idea for an article someday.
Well, I think we can avoid that if the state's executives and the state legislatures actually read the federal constitution, because they have the single most powerful weapon to control the federal government that exists. They can call a constitutional convention. And that means all hell's going to break loose.
And that's never happened.
Can you see?
That's never happened, right?
But it's in the Constitution now.
No, I know.
Can you see Harry Reid? No. But can you see Harry Reid or Mitch McConnell or John Boehner? And Obama has no hand in this. The president has nothing to do with it. Saying, you want to change what? And because we didn't, you know, prepare the constitutional amendment and send it out for your approval, you're just going to trash the whole thing? Fire us all, because that's exactly what happens. If the old constitution is gone, they don't have jobs.
Hmm.
There is no government. So you can't be a senator in a government that doesn't exist.
Right, yeah, there's no way to pay you.
So, okay, fellas, we won't call one, but we want this amendment right now. It could be term limits for Congress. It could be balanced budget amendments. It could be any of those things. And you need 34 states in order to call a constitutional convention. We have 30 states that have Republican governors and 27 that have Republican state legislatures. I'm thinking, you know, it's not that hard to get the last seven states to make that threat credible.
Right.
Sorry, I don't mean to rant on your time.
No, that's okay. That's okay. It's a fascinating topic. I mean, this thing about the Constitutional Convention, I had never thought of that as an option, but that is something. Why don't you write an article about that? And well, maybe you did. I don't know. I don't remember. But why don't you propose that idea
on
an article?
It's probably in my book.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, because I think that's a fascinating idea, but we're out of time, and we'll have to wait until the next time. But the name of the article is Your Bill of Rights, or the Bill of Rights.
Second Bill of Rights or a Bill of Goods.
Right. And we have a link to your archives and the show information. Give us a quick hint. What's coming up next? What's your next article?
Well, right now I'm trying to finish my book. I wasn't joking about that.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
It's a compendium of about 100 of my articles that I've written over the past 3 years. And,
wow. Like a summary of all, I mean, not a summary, but as you say, a collection of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah, it's broken down foreign affairs and the presidency and policy and so on.
When do you expect that to be out?
I would say in about 3 weeks.
Oh,
three
wow.
or 4 weeks.
Wow. Well, we'll have to bring you back. That sounds like a wonderful.
It's in the edit mode now, which means I gave it to a total stranger and I don't know what they're going to do with it.
Well, having just published my own book, I know what that means. When you give it to the editor and you get it back, in this case it was a lady who edited the book, and she did a great job, by the way. When you get it back, it's like at times you're saying, okay, I guess I'm not as good a writer as I thought I was. But you do get it back. And, of course, in your case, it's easy, though, because most of these are articles that have already been published. In my case, I was starting from scratch when I wrote my book. I mean, I was literally starting from scratch. It wasn't a collection of articles that I had written before. Although that is really a neat idea, though, to go back and put everything in one place. I think that's kind of a neat idea. I wish more people would do that. I know George Will used to do that. Several of his books were that way, a collection of columns. I do remember getting a couple of them, and that's the way they were, nothing but like a collection of columns that he wrote over time. Well, Jim, have a wonderful
Thomas
day.
Thomas Sowell's done it as well, too.
Yeah. Don't get any more snow. And we look forward to your next article and having you back.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. You take care.
All right. You have a good day up there in New York, Jim. And we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. And we're going to hear from my good friend, Aaron Clary, who's got a very interesting new book that he just put out. Well, Enjoy the Decline. Now, that's a good title. I want you to listen to Aaron. He's going to explain his book.
Hey everybody, this is Aaron Clary, friend of Canto Talk and author of the book Worthless. Look, normally I'm a happy-go-lucky fella, but let me talk about something very serious. Most likely you or someone you know is depressed about the 2012 election and what it means for the future of the country. And when I say depressed, I really mean it. I'm talking clinical depression. It materially affects your happiness, it destroys any hope you have in the future. Heck, I know guys who are borderline suicidal just because they don't seem to have any hope or future in the country. Well, do me, yourself, or any one of your loved ones a favor and buy my new book, Enjoy the Decline. While the Sean Hannitys of the world are singing, "Don't worry, be happy, my American friend," none of what they say does anything to effectively address your genuine and real concerns about our country and your future. Enjoy the Decline does. Now, I'm not saying the book is going to be all roses and wiener dogs. It's not. I call it like it is and don't sugarcoat it one bit. But I explain how to financially, emotionally, mentally, and above all else, practically adjust to the economic and political realities of the U.S. I explain why there is real hope and a future for every freedom-loving American. You only got one life to live on this planet. Don't let Obama and the socialists ruin it for you. Enjoy the Decline instead. You can get Enjoy the Decline on Amazon.com, available in both paperback and Kindle, and trust me, it's worth the money.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and that's the book Enjoy the Decline by Aaron Clary. Aaron wrote another book called Worthless. It's a very interesting book. I mean, he's basically telling you, hey, you know, we're going to go through a little decline here, so you might as well get ready for that and keep your eyes open and take advantage of some opportunities, you know, that there may be out there. So check out his book, Enjoy the Decline. We have a link to his website on the show information because he's got several books you may want to look at. But his website, of course, is Captain Capitalism. So check him out, and this, I think, is a book that you may want to share with maybe your family and so on. Interesting idea, Enjoy the Decline. Well, we had a great chat with Jim Yardley. Jim, of course, from New York, and he's a contributor to The American Thinker, and we talked a little bit about an article that he just wrote about the second Bill of Rights, how the Bill of Rights started out as basically your rights as a citizen, but has become more and more, it's not officially that, but that's what they want it to be, more and more the entitlements, the things that government is going to do for you, like a living wage or health insurance or whatever. And these are things, you know, decent housing, you know, the kinds of things that we've heard from many Democrats over the years and from many politicians over the years. But the problem is all of this comes with a very, very big price tag. Number one, it costs a lot of money. You know, if you don't believe what I'm saying, just look at Europe and look at the taxes that they pay up in Europe so they can have all of these entitlements. And the other thing also is that it really destroys the individual because it destroys your incentives to work. And Jim was talking about, you know, the single mother who is better off basically not making enough money because she has all these benefits. If she went out and actually made money, then she would have to pay taxes. So we're creating this terrible dependency, which is in many cases now generations, where you have this generation having babies who are then dependent, and the next generation. It just becomes something that destroys the country, destroys the fabric of a self-reliant country. And, you know, we got to fight this. But, of course, it's difficult because, let's face it, it's a lot more popular to give things away than it is to tell people to be self-reliant. I just saw a headline that President Obama, on his State of the Union address tomorrow, is going to call for a new round of spending. And I'm sitting there saying, I mean, this is incredible. Doesn't this man understand that we're already spending $3 trillion and that we're running deficits and that we're creating this debt? Doesn't he understand that we just had a stimulus, a $1 trillion stimulus that didn't stimulate anything? I mean, doesn't he understand this? Well, I guess he probably does, but he also understands that there's a political market for making all these promises, and you make all these idiotic promises, and then, of course, the Congress rejects them, And then you say those terrible Republicans, they're the ones who don't want to give you your decent wage. They're the ones who don't want to give you your decent housing or your living wage. And the other thing that I love, you know, when we talk about, they're going to invest money in infrastructure and bridges and in roads. But were we supposed to do that with the stimulus? I mean, wasn't the stimulus supposed to do that? And that was proposed 4 years ago, and it didn't do any of it. But yes, he keeps coming back with the same message, and the reason he does, I hate to say this, but the reason he does is because politically it works. It works for him politically. Look, he just got reelected. It wasn't a big victory. I mean, he won with just, a little bit over the majority, but he won. He won, and he was able to win because he was able to make all these speeches and make all these statements and make Romney into some kind of a monster who's going to take away kill your wife or whatever by taking, buying the business and selling it to offshore and all this kind of stuff. But it works. I hate to say it, it works. It works because you have a what they call low-information voters who buy into all of this, and they're the ones who keep reelecting him. So I don't know what the Republicans are going to do. I understand Senator Rubio is going to deliver the response. Well, it'd be interesting for him, I think. I hope that Senator Rubio tomorrow night comes up with very specific proposals and say, look, this is what we're going to do. This is what we stand for. This is how we counter what President Obama is saying. I hope he does that. I hope he gives more than just a little general speech. I hope he gets very specific and say, this is what we believe, and this is our outline. This is our competing plan, if you will. This is what we want to do. And put that up against President Obama. It'd be interesting to see if that would actually work. I think it would, because I think those ideas would work. But we got to have a plan. We got to have somebody who can deliver the plan. And as much as I love Mitt Romney, it just didn't work the last time. But maybe with somebody like Senator Rubio and others, maybe it can work. Well, my thanks to Jim Diarley for joining us today. Great chat with Jim. Always enjoy talking with him. He's a contributor to The American Thinker. And my thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back the next time. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Everybody have a wonderful day.